This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stachow. And when we use terms like gay and straight, we assume everybody knows what we're talking about. But it's not necessarily true for the native people of the United States, or at least not historically. In Mark Rifkin's latest book, he explores how the United States government used sexuality as a way of controlling Indians. In particular, he looks at how Westerners used the concept of the nuclear family to erode native notions of kinship and stage a continent-wide theft of native land. The book is called When Did Indians Become Straight? Kinship, the History of Sexuality and Native Sovereignty. And it won the 2011 John Hope Franklin Prize for the Best Book in American Studies in 2011. Mark Rifkin is an associate professor of English and Women's and Gender Studies at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, and he joins us here at the Upstage Cabaret. Welcome, Mark. Good to have you here. So what is the premise of this book?
So, well, before I talk about the sort of argument of the book specifically, there are two points that I think need to be made, one about Native sovereignty, one about sexuality. The first is that Native peoples are peoples. They're political entities whose existence on their own lands precedes the presence of Europeans on this continent, precedes the existence of the U.S., and then settlers, people from elsewhere, come and settle over top of them and create a nation, and that's a colonial act. That's one sort of premise for the book. So Native peoples are sovereign over their own lands. Another is that sexuality, as Frank was saying a moment ago, we tend to think we know exactly what that is. It's just natural. It's biological. But the kinds of categories and identities that we associate with sexuality, the relationship we think of between desire and gender and family and homemaking and land tenure and property and child rearing, all of those are historical. They have histories and they're culturally specific. Right. So then in this book, what I'm thinking of is how your American ideas about home and family and property get imposed on Native peoples in ways that are about making possible the absorption of Native lands into the U.S. and the breaking up of Native political entities.
And what you point out is that it's more than just the desire, perhaps, among Christian populations and preachers and priests to turn you into civilized human beings by their standard. It really is an economic and political project, what you have to do to change family structure.
Right, because if you have a nuclear family, if that's your model, it's a very small unit, and it occupies a very small bit of property, right? Your single family home. If you think about Native nations occupying tens, hundreds of thousands of acres and having connections among them that are organized around what we might call kinship, right? Or extended connections, which your Americans often think of as family, right? Connections. If you then say, well, Native people don't have real home and family and need to be taught to have real home and family, part of what you're saying is then those tens or hundreds of thousands of acres, well, that can be reduced to little plots held by each individual family. And then also the forms of social life and government that are organized around those extended kinship networks, you can treat those as just misunderstandings of what family is. It's not that they have their own governments that are different from the U.S. government. It's instead that they don't really understand what it means to have family. So the argument that Native people need to be trained to have home and family is an argument against recognizing Native people's own forms of government and an argument for breaking up Native land holdings into much, much smaller units.
Which makes it much easier to buy and absorb, as you say, into the other culture. And you point out early in the book, in fact, before you even begin, this quote by Rick Santorum to tell us sort of how far we've come in understanding what is natural and normal for human sexual behavior, right?
Right. And this is a quote by Rick Santorum where he essentially says that the man-woman nuclear family pairing, that this is necessary for all of civilization and has been true for all civilizations throughout human history, which is simply empirically false. It's just not actually accurate as a description of history or other cultures, or even really in your Americans' own history. But what interests me there is he's talking about the dangers that same-sex marriage poses to civilization. But what he's also suggesting, though, is that all of those peoples historically who have not counted as civilization, right, that they don't seem to fit into his vision of what can count as a real society, a viable society. So there is a clear, I would say, if you think about it, racializing imperial element to those kinds of claims about the relationship between the nuclear family and civilization per se.
Where do the ideas of gay and straight fit into all of this?
So gay and straight are categories that come out of late 19th century sexual science, otherwise known as sexology, that homosexual and heterosexual as categories don't exist until really 1892 and 1900 respectively. So those categories and ways of thinking and understanding desire is based on object choice, the sex of the person you're attracted to. They're fairly recent inventions, and they're Euro-American inventions. So those ways of thinking about desire, coupling, homemaking are Euro-American ideas, which have very little to do with, historically, Native people's understandings of themselves.
So how did ideas of homosexuality, transgender, categories that we've created very recently, as you suggest, if we were to go in and recognize that sort of behavior and activity, how was it seen in Native cultures, mm-hmm. and how was it incorporated into this much broader kinship mm-hmm. cooperative structure that worked so well for so many centuries?
Well, there are two ways of approaching that. One, that many Native peoples have social statuses, kinds of roles, which if you're thinking from a Euro-American perspective, you may see as homosexual or cross-dressing or transgender. However, the way that those roles function within those societies doesn't really fit those categories. It's we mistranslate it into Euro-American terms. On their own, they have dimensions, contours, which are not the same as those categories. So we ask something like, well, where is the Sioux version of homosexuality, as opposed to asking, where's the Euro-American version of the Sioux Winkte, right, which is a status among Sioux peoples. So that's one sort of issue.
Well, and explain that. And before you do, I should say that when you say Euro-American, as in Euro-American, mm-hmm. not your Charlotte, not your Carolina Panthers.
Right.
All right. I just want to clarify that.
Right.
So it's EUR.
Right.
But how would that, so describe that role and how that would played in Sioux culture.
Well, Winkte in particular has a role to play in ceremony, to some extent in child rearing, but I have a certain hesitation in talking about it just because I think that it's very easy for non-natives to go looking for statuses that seem to them to resemble Euro-American forms of homosexuality and gender difference. And that historically, one of the things I talk about in the book is that's been a problem with non-native people looking to native peoples for affirmation of themselves, for what they see as possibilities that are other than that of the nuclear family. But that search for validation from Native peoples or Native examples has very little to do with Native people's own struggles for self-determination, Native people's own efforts to exert control over their governance and their land, and that searching for Native examples can function as another form of non-Native appropriation. But I also want to say in response to your previous question, how does homosexuality relate to Native kinship? For other peoples, there wasn't a specific status, and it didn't matter precisely because the nuclear family unit and these little reproductive couplings as the center of society simply wasn't the model. If your society is organized around, let's say, forms of homemaking where everyone from the same mother lives near each other and they cooperatively labor to support each other, it doesn't really matter exactly who's living in what house, and sexual identity as we understand it just really isn't relevant. So for some peoples, there is a status that we might, I think, improperly translate into Euro-American terms. But for other peoples, there is no status, not because there wasn't eroticism between people of the same sex, but just because it wasn't understood as something that needed a name separate from other things because the society was structured differently.
So if we think about your research and what you've looked into, it really sheds a light on how the construction of the nuclear family, a centuries-old construction in Europe, European and American culture, really does come to the service of a particular political and economic model. It really does serve capitalist modes of production and imperialism. It's what justifies it and supports it. I mean, is that pretty close to correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That especially when you're talking in terms of family life, because family life is connected to reproduction and childcare, then often the forms of family life that we have, we can imagine that those are natural, inevitable, biological. So when you're using the nuclear family as a model and you're imposing that on Native people and you're imposing a particular form of political economy organized around private property, organized around a separation, absolute separation between family and government, when you're imposing that on Native peoples, you can treat that as just the natural norm. You're teaching them, right? Ironically, you're teaching them what is supposed to be natural, but that's never really actually considered. It's instead that this form of political economy organized around private property, that is necessary for proper family and proper reproduction and is just natural, as opposed to an imposition, as opposed to a colonial taking of Native lands, as opposed to a colonial exertion of political authority over Native peoples who, prior to the existence of the U.S., and many still, are independent, autonomous political entities.
In kinship and collectivist form, which doesn't really work well if you're trying to atomize a workforce, let's say, or subatomize as a nucleus is, right? It's a subatomic particle, it turns out.
Right, right. But it's also that I think that an important point to make is that the breaking up of Native entities and the attempt to insert Native peoples into U.S. forms of government, that this is less historically about labor, about getting access to Native labor, than it is about getting access to land. And this is one of the principal things that distinguishes, let's say, the history of Native peoples in the U.S. from the history of people of African descent and the legacies of slavery. It's important when we think about things that we understand that there are varieties of racism and racialization that work differently, that have different kinds of political stakes. And for Native peoples, the issue is the effort by the U.S. to claim that Native lands are part of the U.S., can be governed by the U.S., and in many ways and at many historical points can be redistributed to non-Natives because the U.S. government says that it can, as opposed to thinking about Native peoples as separate political entities who have a right under international law to govern their own land bases.
Took an interesting approach in researching this. You did it through literature and took a look at various forms of literature and various pieces of literature throughout history to track the changes. Tell us about that and some of the books that you used.
Well, I think that it's important. I mean, I look at government documents. It's important to think about government documents. We're talking about Indian policy. We're not just talking about random people on the quote-unquote frontier doing things. Right? These are orchestrated forms of policy over time. But it's also important to think about the ways that the ideas informing policy, one, don't stay there, but also don't necessarily come from there. So we need to think about how other kinds of writing, other kinds of cultural production are taking part, right, in this thinking about Native peoples, this justification of U.S. expansion. So looking at fiction, right, various kinds of fiction from the early 19th century through to last decade, one of the things that I wanted to think about was how do non-Native writers take part in these kinds of ideas which show up in policy, but also how do Native writers and Native intellectuals respond to these claims that the U.S. is making, the attempt to naturalize and normalize your American forms of home and family. So perhaps most famously, the most famous text I'm talking about is James Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohicans. But I'm also looking at Other texts in the period, like Catherine Maria Sedgwick's novel Hope Leslie, and it, in the latter part of the text, it looks at writings by lesbian and gay authors. One chapter is on a non-Native writer named Leslie Feinberg. Another is on a Creek writer named Craig Womack. So there's a wide range of writers, both Native and non-Native, spanning about a 200-year period.
And let's talk about Last of the Mohicans. Why? What did you learn in analyzing that and the relationship between Hawkeye and Chingachgook? Anything in that?
Well, I must say first that I didn't actually want to write about Last of the Mohicans. However, given the fact that I'm writing on this topic about the early 19th century, you kind of can't avoid it. So I did end up writing about Last of the Mohicans. And what I'm arguing there is that white family gets understood as central to the development of the nation, and that Native people are understood as a threat to that white family, and that Native people are presented as not really understanding how family works, and in that way, they threaten the future of the nation. And not only are they ultimately vanishing and just going to be extinct in and of themselves, but they need to be moved off in order to make room for the expansion of the white family. And with respect to Hawkeye in Chingachgook, who is the father of the titular last of the Mohicans, they have a relationship which some people have thought of as possibly homoerotic, and I do think that there's a good deal of evidence in the text and other texts written by Cooper about them that would support that. But what interests me, though, is that thinking about them as a couple, even an eroticized couple, one of the things that that leaves aside is the possibility that Hawkeye could have been adopted as a member of the Delawares, which is the people from whom Chingachgook comes. Women would be the ones historically to do that, but that there could be a kinship connection to them, which also has relationship to Native forms of diplomacy in the period. The novel leaves that aside entirely. And instead, it's just this sort of male-male couple where Hawkeye is supporting Chingachgook, who, with the death of his son Uncas, himself becomes the last of the Mohicans. So it's this kind of intimacy at the end of Native presence, rather than Hawkeye becoming a member of the Delawares in ways that suggest that Delaware identity is not about race, but is in fact about belonging to a political entity and a relationship among political identities organized around kinship terms, a diplomacy very, very different from what the U.S. was using at the time.
You know, I've only got about a minute left, but what happens when gay and lesbian writers take this on? Because you warned about the danger of appropriating the sexuality for their own purposes. That's one of the dangers.
I mean, I think absolutely. And it's where non-Native writers are looking to Native peoples, as I was suggesting earlier, for examples of other ways of having a society that don't seem so organized around straightness. And what this doesn't do is think about Native sovereignty, about Native political authority, about the struggles of Native peoples, about their own forms of self-representation. And I think a way to be an ally is to engage with Native understandings of themselves, Native struggles for political authority in the present moment, and as myself, a non-Native queer person, to struggle against straightness not by taking from, but by contributing to a struggle against U.S. colonialism.
Mark Rifkin, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. Mark Rifkin is an associate professor of English and Women's and Gender Studies at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. The book is called When Did Indians Become Straight? Kinship, the History of Sexuality and Native Sovereignty. Just ahead, we will talk with the band, The Brand New Life. Here they are right now on The State of Things. Stay tuned.
Mm-hmm.